You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along, another piece of America's lost.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. As you can tell, it is late on a Friday, which I suspect will afflict all of us as we keep moving through this episode. All of us, including Danny Anderson, assistant professor of English at Mount Aloysius College in Crescent, Pennsylvania. Danny, how's it going?
I'm doing really well. This has been a terrific semester for me so far, so I'm really enjoying life. It's good.
Awesome. That's perhaps unusual to hear midway through a spring semester, but...
The smugness with which he says it, too.
And for me... Well, last semester was such a train wreck for me. I had so many obligations and too many classes, and this semester is just so much more streamlined and normal in terms of pace that I just feel like I have all this time to do kinds of cool stuff. So I'm living life and enjoying it.
Maybe
so.
You're just not doing a very good job.
That's, well, I've given up doing that a long time ago. Yeah, that's I've stopped even calculating that into the equation.
Also joining us today is Michael Farmer. Probably by the time this drops, Man About Town.
No, well, yeah, I don't know when this is dropping.
Yeah, it almost certainly
from college probably by the time it comes out.
Almost certainly not this semester. So,
yeah. So, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. Hopefully, something by the time this airs.
You should like make up something right now, like predict what you will be doing whenever this airs, and just
working in the peanut butter factory from Mr. Rogers.
I was going to go the Trump Tower supervising manager, Michael Farmer.
My father told me to try to get a job writing speeches for Trump.
You know, if you apply, there is like a high chance that you will get a job in the White House, as long as you don't criticize Trump in the application.
Could you apply for a job with Trump without criticizing him?
I mean, I could apply. Like, the first time they check my public social media feed, I'd be disqualified. But
you think he goes that far?
I would write, "Dear President Gorilla, oops."
I think it's probably the sole criteria for employment. I mean, certainly not experience.
You have to be willing to act like he is competent, virtuous, or human.
I mean, I guess I could act like that as long as I can be clear that I'm acting. Like, it's I know, the Ed and I were chatting about this once, like, would we ever consider a sponsor? Like, and what if it's a sponsor we disagree with? And I won't say what Ed thought because he's not here and it wouldn't be fair, but my thought is kind of like, yeah, even if I disagree with him, as long as I can say I have been paid to say X, Y, and Z things, maybe
By the time this airs, CHP and CFP will have had sponsor advertisements. But it's for like Zondervan Bibles or something. It's nothing. It's nothing anybody would need to be horrified by.
I'm calling out there, anybody that wants to advertise vaping or anything like that on Sectarian Review is
vaping.
I used to call to get Lucky Strike to advertise so I could sing the song from the old Jack Benny show. Smoke a Lucky. I would be great. I would totally sing it. Every episode. Plus, they'd probably get free Lucky Strikes.
I'm actually surprised. I would think that podcasts would be out of the FCC's purview, and cigarette companies should be able to advertise on podcasts. I wonder if
Blue,
they've just
Blue
not
Apron
thought of this.
Blue Apron advertises so much that they don't have space for anybody else.
Well, maybe Blue Apron includes cigarettes. Like, you get the meal.
Yeah, like Blue Apron, but you roll your own cigarettes. that's your million-dollar idea, Coyle.
I'll get right on that. All right, well, our topic today is not corporate sponsorship or cigarettes or any of those things, although I suppose it's not unrelated to any of that either. We're talking about country music, and we're talking about country music specifically in the 50s and 60s. Oh, I guess I have an introductory question on here. Yeah, we've done enough chit chat. We'll save that for next time. The problem that country music runs into at, coming out of the 1950s is a problem that we've already talked about, especially relevant to the Nashville sound. The problem of commercialization, uniformity, and stagnation. Country music is just getting at this point closer and closer and closer to pop. The sounds are smoothing out. The big band feel, at least is, you know, 60s-ish big band feel anyway, is starting to dominate. And all of that is really brought together by television. So in the 50s and 60s, there are these two clusters of attempts to get country music TV shows off the ground, with three attempts in each cluster. The shows that were most successful were sort of ironically the shows that resisted those three aspects of the problem country music is running into. So stagnation and commercialization and uniformity. Contrary to the wisdom of the networks, being more authentically country led ultimately to better ratings. So the first set of attempts to put TV put country on TV was the Ozark Jubilee that started in Springfield, Missouri regionally and then moved on to ABC from 56 to 60. The Midwestern Hayride that started in Cincinnati in the 40s and moved to NBC from 55 to 60. And then the one that, if anyone knows any of these, it's probably this one, the Porter Wagner Show. It began nationally from Nashville and ran from 60 to 81 and gave Wagner really the opportunity to stick to his rural roots when these other shows were getting increasingly glossy and increasingly commercial. When the Nashville sound is kind of driving everyone in the same direction, Wagner intentionally keeps rustic imagery. He wears, you know, rhinestone-covered nudie suits and plays hard country. The guy was apparently also some kind of workaholic, so he performed more than 200 concerts a year in addition to his TV show and his time spent on the Grand Ole Opry. You guys have anything to say about those three? Otherwise, I'll move on to the second grouping of them.
I've never seen any of them.
Porter Wagner is actually where Dolly Parton got her first mainstream exposure, actually. And I think that there was some romantic relationship there, but then she sort of utterly eclipsed everyone else on the show and became the phenomenon that she is. Which, by the way, I think on that topic, I think in the last time we recorded about, like, I think during about George Jones, I think I made the statement that, you know, you think about the greatest voices in country music. I think I probably should have included Dolly Parton in that list. I think I said George Jones or Merle Haggard or something, but I think I regretted not including Dolly Parton in there. And she became, you know, famous via the Porter Wagner Show.
It's hard to argue she's not the greatest female voice in country music, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I have seen a bit of the Porter Wagner Show. I've not seen the other two. In part, I've seen it because Porter Wagner is from my part of Missouri. As I was trying to learn about the place I was moving to, that was one of the names that popped up. He's from a little town just up the road from us. The second cluster of attempts at kind of a nationwide country TV show, these are all from starting in 1969. They include the Glen Campbell Good Time Hour on CBS. It ran for 3 years from 69 to 72. The Johnny Cash Show on ABC ran for 2 years from 69 to 71. And then on CBS, Hee Haw ran from 69 to 93, although some of that was in syndication. Obviously, the networks didn't know which shows were going to make it and which ones didn't, but the common themes in their attempts were always the Nashville sound, over-stylized productions, and parallels with pop music, so bringing on pop singers as guest stars and so on. The two that are the most successful, the Porter Wagner Show and Hee Haw, are the shows that resist those tendencies the most. They're given sort of more flexibility to stick to a pure country music, and they do better in the long run. I'm reading this this history of country music kind of as we're going through this. It says that of the shows that didn't survive, country music itself received little emphasis, and country fans did not mourn their rather abrupt departure from television programming.
Did Johnny Cash interview people on the Johnny Cash Show?
I don't know if it was formal interviews. I've only ever seen the musical bits from the shows. I don't know if like he sat down at a table and interviewed them, but I know there were, like, he would stop and ask them questions and give them a chance to tell stories and such. I've never seen a whole episode, so I don't know if there was kind of a portion when they sat down and talked for a while or not.
Have either of you seen the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour? I figured that must be the cheesiest, corniest show ever.
I've not seen it. And
then Glenn Campbell is just a master of corn.
That's true.
I mean, I say that even though Wichita Lineman may be the greatest country song ever written. Like, I'm not putting him down for being a master of corn, but
sure.
It's weird though that because he is also one of the most, maybe the most prodigiously talented musician in country history, right?
And oh, sure.
He's a studio musician. He's also an amazing vocalist. I think you could probably put him next to George Jones and Merle Haggard.
Yeah.
Play the heck out of the bagpipes too.
I don't know that reference.
Literally, he can play the bagpipes. Like,
wow.
In his concerts, he would often break them out and do a rendition of Amazing Grace. Or,
that's awesome.
I mean, he's really amazing.
Everybody needs a hobby, I guess.
He wrote
a record in 2008, I think, that was covers of pop songs, and they're really fantastic. It sounds like it would be a novelty. But he does All I Want Is You by U2, and it's a really great version of it. Much better than the Johnny Cash one, I must say.
And on the subject of the Porter Wagoner Show, before we let it go, that was the explicit, I think, influence for Marty Stewart's show, which was very much a throwback to that kind of time period of a show. And I was actually lucky enough to go to a taping of a couple of those episodes. I just loved watching them. It was so kind of pure and just so unlike anything else on television that it seemed like vital and exciting in a way that nothing else was, because of probably the same reason that these shows were successful, is that they were so idiosyncratically country that's why they succeeded. You could argue whether they were authentically country or not, right? But they were idiosyncratically country, and that set them apart from these things that tried to kind of just approach country generically like any other form of music, right? And so,
which is what was happening everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Country is becoming more and more like pop in the 60s until, again, it was, to steal a phrase from this history I'm reading, it was reinvigorated by these three different streams, influences flowing together at the same time. So we're just each going to take one of these and kind of give a quick overview of them.
Well, before we move on, I think we ought to say something more about Hee Haw, which is like a cultural touchstone, even though I've never seen it. And then no idea it ran all the way to 1993.
Yeah, I remember growing up arguing with my dad about whether we would watch. He wanted to watch Hee Haw, and I wanted to watch the Disney Hour. And they came on at the same time. And I seem to remember losing many of those arguments, and in retrospect, I don't regret that. It was a great show, but it was still on, you know, when I remember watching TV.
When we get to Buck Owens, though, he famously, he wrote a book called Buckham, I think is the name of his biography. he was another master of corn, but in that book, I think he says how much he hated being on Hee Haw, and he's sort of like the face of Hee Haw with Roy Clark, right?
Yeah. What's the George Jones song? I'm a bartender and I don't like my job, but I sure like the money.
Yeah, that's exactly his sentiment, is that he couldn't find a good reason to turn down the money for having to show up for a couple weeks a year and what he, the quote he's had was, whore himself out for that cartoon donkey.
All I can think of is the Simpsons version of Hee Haw, Yahoo, where they say, starring in alphabetical order, Yodelin' Zeke. Big shirtless Ron. I've never seen Hee Haw, so I don't really know how accurate that is.
I don't remember it well enough to be able to say. I've seen clips of it since on, you know, on YouTube and such. But my memories of it are pretty positive. They seem to have done a good job kind of capturing the music and the humor that goes along with all of the things about country music we've talked about, the poverty and the hard work and all of that, from a more cheerful perspective, but still being honest about it. And is it Archie Campbell, right, is the comedian?
What, who?
Archie Campbell is the comedian that they have on. Again, I have memories of that are pretty fantastic, too. Try to throw some clips up on the show notes if I remember, you know, 10 months from now when this drops.
But seriously, 1993, was it on a network in 1993?
I'm sure that was
syndication.
Syndicated.
Yeah.
Okay. Still, that's crazy. I had no idea it went for so long.
All right, anything else about the TV shows? Otherwise, we should get to the main stuff today.
Buck Owens had one.
He had a separate show from
Hee
Haw?
from 66 to 72, I do believe, or early 70s, called the Buck Owens Ranch Show, I think is what it was called. And if you look at any Buck Owens videos on YouTube, they're basically clips of that with him and Don Rich and the Buckaroos singing in their nudie suits. But it was a pretty good, just a showcase of a lot of his, like, singles. I mean, it was, yeah, a really good show, though.
Is it worth talking about the trend in late 60s sitcoms, the kind of rural sitcom? It seems connected, not unconnected anyway, to Hee Haw to me. Like, you have the Beverly Hillbillies and Green Acres, Petticoat Junction, all this stuff where they're interested in pandering to rural Americans. And then, I forget what year, but there's Hee Haw survives it, but nothing else does. It's called a rural purge, which is difficult to say and also kind of fun. But there was this whole movement in the late 60s to kind of portray rural America, and I suspect all of those shows are part of that.
I'm just not familiar enough with TV in the 60s and 70s. I assume, like, Dukes of Hazzard would have come after that then.
Yeah, that's after that. That's 80s, in the late. This is stuff like Green Acres and Petticoat Junction.
Right.
I've seen them, but and I always took them to be like spin-offs of Andy Griffith. And so, which also intersects, there's all sorts of storylines in the Andy Griffith Show of local musicians who go off and, you know, and play authentic country music and that sort of thing. And so, so I always took it, maybe Andy Griffith was part of that move too then.
Right. Yeah, when was the Andy Griffith Show? I think of that as being the 50s, but it's probably not, huh?
No, I think it's 1960 that it starts. Okay. It's in the early part of the 60s and it runs through most of the 60s, I think.
Yeah, I know so little about TV, I have nothing to add. Anything else about Porter Wagoner, Hee Haw, Andy Griffith? Moving then into some of the bigger subject matter, the first stream that influences and reinvigorates country music is folk music. In the 60s, there's this movement called the Urban Folk Revival. This folk revival in the 60s, it's sort of a misnomer. Like bluegrass, it's kind of a pseudo old-timey sound, but it's really a fairly modern genre. So to talk about revival in the 60s, well, the first folk movement comes from just a couple of decades earlier in the 40s, late 30s, early 40s, so Woody Guthrie and so on. But still, there's this fresh movement in the 60s, especially on college campuses, that gets called folk. It is really just kind of a subgenre of pop music with musicians like Bob Dylan and Joni Mitchell. But they still influence country music, and they're two main influences. First, they provide new fans, people who like the music but don't want to go the rock direction and sort of follow the folk trail to Janis Joplin or Graham Parsons. Instead, they want something that's, you know, yet more old-timey sounding. The second influence is it inspires country musicians, both in terms of writing and performance style. And I love this example. So Johnny Cash steals this folk style when he performs John Henry's Hammer, a classic folk song. It takes him 8 minutes to play it. It's again that sort of narrative, taking your time telling the story. At one point, he's like banging a hammer on a steel bar in the middle of the song. It's clearly, you know, being driven by what he's hearing in folk music.
John Henry's pappy woke him up one midnight. He said, "Before the sheriff comes, I want to tell you, listen, boy." Said, "Learn to ball a jack, learn to lay a track, learn to pick and shovel too, and take my hammer. It'll do anything you tell it to." John Henry's mammy had about a dozen babies. John Henry's pappy broke jail about a dozen times. The babies all got sick, and when the doctor wanted money, he said, "I'll pay you a quarter at a time. Start tomorrow. That's a pay for a steel driver on his line."
So, of these musicians who are heavily inspired, of course Johnny Cash is one we've already talked about. Waylon Jennings moves from rock to country music through the folk channel. His later stuff is more famous, and we'll get back to him. But his early country work is made up of re-recorded songs like "Man of Constant Sorrow," "Kisses Sweeter Than Wine," "House of the Rising Sun." He comes from the rock world kind of through that passageway. Jimmy Newman had started out his career singing Cajun music. I hesitate to call that French, but you know he's singing whatever corrupt French that goes into Cajun, and then rides along with the Nashville sound for a while before moving back into Cajun music, which he then intentionally associates with sort of a country folk style. So his album "Folk Sounds of the Bayou Country" sells very, very well and cements his place kind of in the country folk industry. The most commercially successful of these guys is Bobby Bear, both because of his sort of folksy style and his stage presence is very, very down home and friendly, but also because he is amazing at getting great songwriters. So Kris Kristofferson, Mel Tillis, Tom T. Hall, and Chel Silverstein, all at various points write songs for Bobby Bear. His songs are interesting. They often involve leaving the farm to go to get a factory job in the city, often to make some woman happy with the city lifestyle, and just being utterly miserable there, and wanting to go back to the farm, or actually going back to the farm. So his songs are about that, or they're about witches. It just kind of depends on what mood you catch him in. I'm assuming you guys have heard the Marie Laveau song.
Down in Louisiana, where the black trees grow, lives a voodoo lady named Marie Laveau. She got a black cat tooth and a mojo bone. Anyone who wouldn't leave her alone, she go. Another man done gone. She lives in a swamp in a hollow log. She ever seen y'all messing around there, she go. Another man done gone.
No, I don't know that one.
I don't think so.
Okay, well, we'll throw a clip of that in. It's pretty fantastic. It's Marie Laveau is this apparently an actual like famous witch legend, whatever, from Louisiana, and in the song she doesn't like men and she vanishes them, and finally some guy comes along and says, if you give me $1 million I'll marry you, and she makes $1 million using magic, and then he says, well, you're too ugly for a rich guy like me, and then she, you know, kills him too. So I mean,
but to be fair, he deserved it.
Oh yeah. It's a great song.
I think I do know that song now. It's deep in my memory, but I think I can hear it right now.
Yeah, and then finally, just I don't have a whole lot else to say about urban folk, but or about the folk revival, but as part of this revival, both country and pop style folk songs rediscover the saga song. So these are narrative songs that are either fictional episodes that are written as if they were real history, or they're real historical events that have been fictionalized. So Johnny Cash, of course, again does a lot with this, but the guy who kind of makes his career doing it is Johnny Horton. Songs like "Springtime in Alaska," "Sink the Bismarck," "Johnny Reb," and most famously "The Battle of New Orleans," right, are all history-ish songs, right? You won't get anything that'll help you pass a history test out of them, but they're also actual historical events.
Took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
Horton was an interesting guy. He actually refused to go on the Grand Ole Opry. He backed out of country music kind of altogether at one point. He preferred to work at a bait and tackle shop because he loved fishing more than he loved music. And he was finally, some people talked him into moving back into music. So he was on his way to perform a concert when he got killed in the car crash. So Horton had married Hank Williams' widow.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, leaving her, you know, sort of twice widowed in the country music world.
Wow. Gosh.
Yeah, so
they both died in cars.
Yeah, on the way to concerts, although at different places, I suppose. So yeah, folk music is clearly influencing the mainstream country of the 60s, and especially going into the 70s, as we'll get to next time. These folk songs are providing inspiration and style alike to what's coming as country is reinvigorated. Anything you guys want to add to that, or otherwise we'll move on to the bigger influences that both of you have.
It's interesting to me listening to you talk about the two strains of folk music. You have kind of a rock version of it and a country folk version of it. And it's just
that is everything I know about folk music.
But it's true though, and I think that there's something going on politically then that's motivating people to revisit the past in various ways. And so country being a more kind of conservative, you know, genre, the old Johnny Horton's, you know, Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi, right? Those sorts of those sorts of heroic narratives of our founders, you know, that it makes perfect sense that you'd see that. Whereas Johnny Cash, I guess, toes that line, because a lot of his narratives are like Ira Hayes and that sort of thing, right? Those tragic stories of American avarice or whatever. And so it's interesting. I had never thought about that. What kind of precipitates this dueling versions of the folk revival in American popular music? I think it's a fascinating question.
Anything else? Otherwise, Danny, take us into the Bakersfield sound.
So Bakersfield sound is a kind of competitor to Nashville. And so it kind of boots up really in the 50s. And the person that's kind of generally thought of as, if you can think of a person originating this sound, is Wynn Stewart. Who became really influential not only in terms of sound, but I think Merle Haggard was his bass player, I think, and Wynn Stewart gave him one of his first hit songs. I think it was "Sing a Sad Song," I think, is a Wynn Stewart penned number, and so he's kind of very responsible for the jump starting of Merle Haggard's career, but also he kind of invents or kind of codifies this sound that's arising in the bars, basically the nightclubs of Bakersfield, California, which is this sort of very working class area populated a lot by the former Okies who left the Dust Bowl era, and their kind of descendants end up here, and they brought that kind of music, and it develops its own sort of distinctiveness. And I don't know if it's because of California or whatnot, but it's very conversational with rock music in a way that country music is not. And so when you think of the Bakersfield sound, you think of a lot more electric instruments, right? And so this is kind of an innovation, if you will, of this form of country music in adopting this popular form of instrumentation. And so you can't even imagine Buck Owens without those electric guitars, right? And so in addition to the electric guitars, you've also got the backbeat that has been sort of imported from rock and roll music. So drums are kind of an important new instrument in this form of country music. And it kind of pushes Nashville to adopt that. There's a real rivalry. Kind of Nashville as a recording town really doesn't like Bakersfield as a recording town, even though most of those were recorded in LA, or Hollywood, but the country radio loved Bakersfield, and so Nashville's sort of forced to adopt it to kind of bring it under its umbrella. And so, but yeah, this is two of the innovations that it has. And it's interesting, Buck Owens is sort of, and when you think of the Bakersfield sound, Buck Owens is the figure to think about. Merle Haggard certainly comes out of that, but he in a way transcends it in a way that Buck Owens doesn't, right? And so Merle Haggard is definitely part of that, but you think of him as a country musician at large, right? He's not so associated with this. But Buck Owens had a real genius for understanding like his audience, right? And so I saw an interview with him, and he was saying that, you know, back at the time, this was all being played in car radios, right? And they're all AM radios, and so all these people are mixing in basses that you can't hear on an AM radio. So I tune the bass way down and turn the treble instruments way up, and that's really does that punchy sound, the trebly sound, is really distinctive, and kind of makes the Bakersfield sound what it is. And Buck Owens is sort of one of those key figures in the development of that sound, along with there's a producer named Ken Nelson who worked with both Merle and Buck Owens. And Ken Nelson is interesting as a record producer, and again in California, in Nashville the producers were like Stalinist dictators, basically. They are the ones who like ran the show, basically, right? And the artists were kind of like at their disposal. They even chose their songs typically for them, and all that, assembled studio musicians.
Very much like Motown, right?
Yeah, very much, right? And so Ken Nelson was a much different, much more hands-off approach, and I think he was much more like attuned to the individual artist. And I think you get that comes out in the Nash, in the Bakersfield sound. You got him working with what people do really well and just sort of allowing that to happen. Buck Owens talks about how he never even heard the songs before they were being recorded in a lot of cases, right? And so there was a different approach to the production of this music. So when you think about the sound as a movement, though, and something that stands in opposition to Nashville, that ultimately, I mean, we listen to country music now and we hear Buck Owens and we think, oh, that's country music for sure. That's classic country music. But at the time there's a distinction, and this does have its own kind of lineage. And so we already talked about like Wynn Stewart and Buck Owens. Gene Shepherd is sort of the, after Kitty Wells, the second probably big female artist. And so she sort of comes out of this milieu as well. And so those are sort of some figures that you can kind of trace a lineage. And so I kind of want to propose an argument that I kind of see at least three branches of current music that are more current music that directly, I think, comes out of this form of country music. One is the neo-traditionalist. So Dwight Yoakam is like famously inspired by Buck Owens and Merle Haggard. And he even records songs with Buck Owens later in his life. And so that sort of neo-traditional sound, I think, draws a lot on this influence from the 80s. That Dwight Yoakam as a kind of figure is someone who keeps that alive in that form of mainstream country music. You also have this sort of California rock milieu. And so here it gets a little bit maybe more tenuous, but somebody like Graham Parsons, I think, is also part of this conversation. The Flying Burrito Brothers was his band that had this very twangy, countrified rock sound that is very consistent with the style that's laid forth by folks like Buck Owens and Wynn Stewart. And so Graham Parsons then has this lineage through Emmylou Harris and all the way through the kind of modern alt country sound, I think. And so when you think of No Depression music or alt country, I think it has a pretty straight line to the Bakersfield sound too, as much or more than most of what you see out of Nashville. And it's also an interesting and powerful influence in British music. The Beatles, of course, famously record Act Naturally, Buck Owens, one of his first big hits. And so they really like that sound. And who's to say why? But it's not just the Beatles. I also think when you think about the British kind of pub rock scene, and particularly someone like Nick Lowe, I think that you can see a lot of real kind of affinity for the stripped down, rockified country of the Bakersfield sound. And it's something that develops because it's outside of the producer control that's existent in Nashville, and it develops its own kind of unique strain and has its own kinds of influences. Now, ultimately, like today, we can think of them in a unified way, like I said, but it's a powerful, like, opposing force to the Nashville sound.
I would not have thought of Graham Parsons. I'm glad you pointed that out. Anything else on Bakersfield? I mean, we could do a whole episode on Buck Owens alone, but
And also, there's actually a really great Cocaine and Rhinestones about Buck Owens. There might be two of them. I think there's one about Buck Owens and one about Don Rich, his guitar player.
Right.
Because they have this really wonderful, intricate, double guitar lead sound on most of their songs.
And the harmony, right, that Don Rich brought to all those songs is, like, really important. Like, Tiger by the Tail, all those, that high accompanying harmony, that's all Don Rich. And when he died, also in, a motorcycle accident on the way to some family vacation or something like that, Buck Owens, like, never recovers from that. That's, like, an emotional... they were closer than brothers. These two guys were so close artistically and in terms of just their personal lives. Buck Owens never really recovers from that. And so it really, Don Rich, and if you watch any of these old YouTube videos with the nudie suits, he's the guy standing kind of next to him, harmonizing with him. It's a really important aspect of the sound, is the kind of accompanying, kind of doubling guitar, treble heavy guitar, and the high harmony as well.
Right, that steel guitar sound that reverberates in the tractor cab. Not that I would be irritated by that. Before we move on, did you want to talk about Buck Owens's pledge to country music?
Oh yeah, you sent me that. I can't believe it. So it's basically this almost like McCarthyist statement of loyalty, kind of. Like, it's hilarious. Yeah. With his picture in this very serious pose, and he's got this I shall sing no song that is not a country song. I shall make no record that is not a country record. I refuse to be known as anything but a country singer. All these sorts of statements of loyalty to the genre. I would love to know what inspired this, if this is some sort of backlash or a preemptive strike against the Nashville backlash about this is not real country or what. But
I think it has to be. I mean, if you look at his career, he never even tried to do a crossover. Playing for country audiences. His sound doesn't really change that drastically over the years. I mean, especially compared to somebody like Merle Haggard.
Mm. I wonder if it's in response to the Beatles covering him. And yeah, Creedence reference him in Looking Out My Back Door. I mean, so he's got like this crossover appeal. His show is also syndicated in like hundreds of cities, right? And so I wonder if this is some sort of like it's coming out of some sort of fear of contamination or something.
I know that Cocaine and Rhinestones talks about that pledge and the motivation behind it. So I would recommend that show.
Sure. Well, with Buck Owens and Merle Haggard, that's a good place to transition into, I didn't have a good name for this third section. There's a renaissance of songwriting, right? Balladeers, maybe, would be a title for them. But people who are original and highly, highly skilled when it comes to writing music. So, Michael, can you talk to us about some of the best songwriters in the 1960s?
Sure. And a lot of this, I think we have to answer the question of what makes a good song and what makes a good country song. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to come to an overarching answer, given the differences in the people I'm going to talk about. I'm not sure what they have in common other than that they're good songwriters and everybody should recognize it. So let's start with Haggard. What really strikes me about his music, especially early on, is how personal it is. I don't know how many of the stories are true, but he is definitely playing off of his background. His background is not an Okie himself, but is the child of Okies. His father dying when he was young, him, of course, going to prison. Everything he sings in those first, I don't know, 10 albums or so feels very much like it's right out of his life. So you get a song, Mama Tried is probably the best song of his early era.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Mama Tried is a really intensely autobiographical song. As far as I know, the only detail that's not true is he wasn't doing life without parole when he turned 21 in prison. But all the other details are straight out of his life, and you feel it. Like there's an honesty to that songwriting. It's not complex, but it's true. You have a song like Branded Man. Branded Man is him trying to get used to everybody thinking of him as a criminal, even after he's released from prison. He has a really killer song called Sing Me Back Home, which is it's about a guy on death row who asks him to play songs he knows before they kill him.
The warden led a prisoner down the hallway to his doom. I stood up, say goodbye like all the rest. And I heard him tell the warden just before he reached my cell. Let my guitar playing friend do my request. Let him sing back home with a song I used to hear and make my old memories come alive and take me away and turn back the years and sing me back home before I die.
And I mean, it's very straightforward. It's very earnest, and it's a really moving, beautiful song. So that's his early stuff. There's a bunch of other songs that are kind of like that. There's a good one called "I Take a Lot of Pride in What I Am," if you know that one, which is about being a hobo. Do you really have a sense of how much of a hobo Haggard was?
No, I don't. I mean, I think it's probably. I mean, I always took it as an image that right. Set him apart from kind of. Privileged society, sort of.
I mean, he's on the road, obviously, a lot, right? So
he's talking about learning things from a hobo jungle that you can't learn in school, and I believe
yeah.
it. You know what? I have no idea if he was actually a hobo, but he sings it with such sings and writes it with such earnestness that I find it difficult not to believe it. And plus, since these other songs are apparently true,
mm-hmm. yeah, his was it Mama's Hungry Eyes? I think
uh-huh.
I saw him in an interview say that his aunt basically that was based on their life because they lived in this tent in a labor camp, right? And so he in visiting his aunt and uncle that was the basis of that song. So it wasn't his mama, but it was true, right?
And
so
yeah, and I mean one thing that's interesting about that period of his career where he's being so open is he never writes songs about his father. And his father dies when he's young. You get a little bit of it in Mama Tried. It's like an offhand reference almost. I don't think he writes a song about his father until the song Kern River, which is from the 80s. Do you know that one?
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful song. It's about fishing with your father, I believe. And I mean, this is a subject he just can't even touch, presumably because it's so much at the heart of what happens to him and who he is and who he wishes he wasn't, despite him saying he takes a lot of pride in what he is. Mm-hmm. He clearly has a lot of shame about the things he did before he was a star and maybe some of the things he did once he was.
Well, I mean, the prison time alone might be enough to, bring some kind of shame.
Right. Am I remembering right that it's Jimmy Carter who pardons him?
I was unaware. I did not know.
Yeah, I thought, it was Jerry Brown. It was the governor of California. He was pardoned.
Okay. Okay.
So then there's a weird period in the 70s, and it's not like this is the only thing he was writing in the 70s, because he's incredibly prolific. I mean, he must put out two or three albums a year for 20 years. But he has this weird period where he's writing songs that are beloved by conservatives. Okie from Muskogee is the most famous one of these.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street. 'Cause we like living right and being free. We don't make a party out of loving, but we like holding hands and pitching woo. We don't let our hair grow long and shaggy like the hippies out in San Francisco do. And I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, a place where even squares can have a ball. We still wave old glory down at the courthouse, and white lightning's still the biggest thrill of all.
Another song that seems very personal, even if you know anything about Merle Haggard, you know it's not personal. It begins, "We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee." And he, you hear various versions of the story, but supposedly he was smoking marijuana when he wrote it. And he was known to say in concert, "That's about the only place I didn't smoke it." And I mean, he was a daily pot smoker for like 40 years. So I don't know who the narrator of Okie from Muskogee is, but it's not him. And the song is at least partially satirical, but it gets picked up. But it gets picked up by conservative America because it's expressing these really corny old fashioned values. What is it? Boots are still in style for manly footwear. Beards and Roman sandals just won't do.
I saw another interview with him somewhere that where he says actually he was driving on tour and saw a sign for Muskogee and knew that in family lore that's where they had come from. And so he kind of imagined his father as what his father would think about modern culture. And so I think the father is the narrator of that song, right?
Oh, that's interesting.
Because he said, like, you know, I understood it, and I was kind of down with all the youth culture stuff, but my dad sure wouldn't understand. So it's almost like he took on a persona of his father there that gets adopted as true.
So Okie from Muskogee is really a pretty great song, however serious the politics are, or whatever you think of the politics. The follow-up is not a good song, The Fight Inside of Me, yeah. which is about cracking some hippie skulls when they protest the Vietnam War. Because when you're running down this country, Hoss, you're walking on the fight inside of me.
Hear people talking bad about the way they have to live here in this country, harping on the wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fight inside of me. They're walking on the fighting side of me, running down a way of life our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down our country, horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
That's a bad song. And again, it's hard.
Oh, it's a great song. What are you talking about?
It's hard to tell how serious he's being. Like, yeah, there's a serious conservative streak in Merle Haggard. There's no way around that. You get it in a lot of different songs. But The Fight Inside of Me is just pure jingo. And he's got some other songs in his career that are just pure jingo, but nothing as bad or as popular as The Fight Inside of Me. By the way, he still played. I saw him in 2008, and he was still playing Fight Inside of Me. He didn't do Okie from Muskogee, but he did Fight Inside of Me, and the crowd cheered.
Did he do the, what's the, are we rolling downhill like a snowball headed
yes.
for hell?
Yes, he did. That's Are the Good Times Really Over for Good, which is a wonderful right. song.
I wish a buck was still silver. It was back when the country was strong. Back before Elvis and before the Vietnam War came along. Before the Beatles and yesterday. When a man could still work, still would. It's the best of the free life behind us now. And are the good times really over for good? And are we rolling downhill like a snowball headed for hell? Kind of chance for the flag or the Liberty Bell. I wish a Ford and a Chevy would still last 10 years like they should. It's the best of the free life behind us now. And are the good times really over for good?
Yeah, he stopped it in the middle. There's the line in the song, something, something, a joint was a bad place to be. Because you know, the song's all about how the words we used in the old days have different meanings now. But he stopped it and he said, a joint was a good place to be. And then everybody in the crowd cheered. And I've since then, I've been trying to figure out if he was talking about marijuana or if he's just saying, you know, I like to go to bad bars. He's kind of inscrutable for someone whose songwriting is so personal. Yeah. The other one from the 70s I would point to, and this is a great song.
I glitched out for a second. What was the name of the song again?
Big City.
Work and never enough play, and I'm tired of these dirty old sidewalks. Think I'll walk off my steady job today. Turn me loose, set me free, somewhere in the middle of Montana. Give me all I've got coming to me, and keep your retirement and your so-called social security. Big city, turn me loose and set me free.
Yeah, and it's a great song, but I mean, it's a song about how you can keep your retirement and your so-called social security.
Right, turn me loose in the middle of Montana instead. Yeah.
Right. So he has this weird conservative streak, and again, that's another song he played at least until 2008, because he opened the show I saw him play with Big City, which I'm not complaining about. It's a great song, but it's weirdly conservative given the crowd he ran with and the amount of marijuana he smoked. You know, like almost everybody else, he has a dark period in the 80s and 90s. country radio is very uninterested in old guys during that period. So I don't think he ever really quite disappears. He's putting out records, but nobody cares about them. Probably the last song he did that anybody cared about was Rainbow Stew. Do you guys remember that?
That's a great song also.
Another Hobo song. Yeah, it is a good song.
There's a big brown cloud in the city and the countryside to sin. The price of life is too high to give up. It's gotta come down again. But worldwide war is over and done, and the dream of peace comes true. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. When we find out how to burn the water and the gasoline car is gone. When an airplane flies without any fuel and the sunlight heats our home. One of these days when the air clears up and the sun comes shining through, we'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew in a silver spoon underneath that sky of blue. We'll all be drinking that free bubble up and eating that rainbow stew. All right, Marky.
But he puts out a really remarkable album in 2000, I think it's just 2000, called If I Could Only Fly. Do you guys know that?
Don't know that one.
He puts it out on Anti Records, which is a punk label. They pick him up. And that album begins, watching while some old friends do a line. So, I mean, there's something kind of punk rock about that, right? And that's a song about how he wishes he could still do drugs, but he doesn't do them anymore. and there's a lot of really personal songs on there. There's a song called Thanks to Uncle John, which is about a relative of his who took him in after his father died. There's a song called Proud to Be Your Old Man about his much younger fifth wife. There's a song called I'm Still Your Daddy, which is not a great song, but it's kind of remarkable because it's about his young children finding out that he was in prison. So it's kind of a sequel to Branded Man. Okay. I think that's a really great album and very moving. And he, you know, put out albums every year until he died. But certainly, like most people, his best stuff is fairly early on. Have I left anything important out about Merle Haggard's songwriting?
I didn't know half of that, so I couldn't answer that.
Well, let's move on and talk about Willie Nelson, who, of course, is a Nashville songwriter before he becomes a megastar in the mid-70s. He is less personal a songwriter than Merle Haggard, and probably that's because he started off writing for other people, so the songs weren't supposed to be self-expression. His early songs are fairly famous. They're famous versions done by other people. Hello Walls was done by, I was going to say Ferlin Husky.
Ferlin Husky, right?
Was it Ferlin Husky?
Yeah, I think so.
Crazy, of course, by Patsy Cline. Who did Nightlife? Ray Price?
That does sound right.
Anyway, those are all great songs. I'm sure they're connected to his life in some way, but listening to him, you certainly don't feel like you're hearing him bare his soul the way Haggard does. By the way, supposedly he wrote Crazy, Nightlife, and Funny How Time Slips Away in 1 week.
That's amazing.
Yeah, like he would never have to do anything else, and he would have gone down in history just for those three songs. We talked to it last time about how his music is jazzier than most country music, and that allows him a little bit more range as a songwriter, I think. Although, I mean, Haggard's got some jazz in there, too. Midway through his career, he starts being an interpreter of other people's songs rather than a songwriter himself. So he'll put out whole albums where he didn't write any of the songs on it, but most of his albums still have an original song or two. And he put out an album 3 or 4 years ago that was all original songs. That was his first one since the 70s, I think. I would say of Willie Nelson that his songwriting is closer to poetry than most country songs are. And I would point to three songs for that, although there's many more. Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground. Do you guys know that one?
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite songs, actually. I love that song.
I was going to say, that's my least favorite Willie Nelson song.
Oh, really?
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's kind of sappy, I think, but...
Well, yeah, and he's not afraid to court that. He has a lot of songs that are kind of cynical, but he's not afraid to be a romantic either. He really does have an enormous range. Another one I don't think people know very well is December Day, which is from his album Yesterday's Wine, which is a really bonkers concept album like most of his records from the 70s.
This looks like a December day.
This looks like a time to remember day. And I remember a spring, such a sweet, tender thing, and love's summer college, where the green leaves of knowledge were waiting to fall with a fall.
December Day is just straight up poetry. I mean, it's as poetic as anything Bob Dylan or Paul Simon ever wrote. So if you don't know December Day, definitely go look that up, along with The Sound in Your Mind, which is another song from that era. It's the title track of the album, The Sound in Your Mind. And I mean, really, these are immensely poetic compared to basically everybody else in country music. He can also be very earthy and direct. These are probably the more famous songs. You get something like On the Road Again. Everybody knows On the Road Again. Everybody loves On the Road Again. I Gotta Get Drunk and I Sure Do Hate It. Down at the Corner Beer Joint. I think that's a remarkable song because it is that kind of earthy, direct song that's also, it's got these hidden wells of sorrow in it. It's about a woman whose husband has cheated on her and she's moved back home. Those are all great songs. They're still recognizably Willie Nelson, but they're not like those other ones. They're not like Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground or December Day. Coyle, you have Mel Tillis on here. And I got to say, I went and listened to a bunch of Mel Tillis compositions for this, and I don't get it. Tell me why I should like Mel Tillis.
So did you listen to Mel Tillis singing or stuff that he wrote?
Both.
Because
I know he's Webb Pierce's songwriter, and he wrote one of the big Webb Pierce songs, and I can't remember which one it is now.
Yeah, I put him under your title so I wouldn't have to be prepared to speak to him. So
of course.
Same thing with Marty Robbins and Tom T. Hall. Although I know their songs a little better than I know Mel Tillis's.
Well, let's forget Mel Tillis.
Yeah, we can leave him. It is my understanding that he is generally considered one of the great songwriters from this era, but I don't know that much about him. So we can leave him out. That's fine. You want to go on with was it Marty Robbins next?
Marty Robbins' reputation is built pretty much entirely on probably the greatest Western song ever written, El Paso.
Sure.
Which I mean, everybody knows.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina, music would play and Felina would whirl. Blacker than night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was deep for this Mexican maiden, I was in love but in vain I could tell. One night a wild young cowboy came in, wild as the West Texas wind. Dashing and daring, a drink he was sharing with wicked Felina, the girl that I love. So in anger I challenged his right for the love of this maiden. Down put his hand for the gun that he wore. My challenge was answered in less than a heartbeat. The handsome young stranger lay dead on the floor. Out through the back door of Roses I ran.
But everybody knows it because it's a really incredible story song with a lot of emotional depth to it. There's also a sequel that he did many, many years later called El Paso City. Do you guys know that song?
It's not very good.
It's bonkers, though, because it's a song about how great the song El Paso is. So it's Marty Robbins singing 20, 30 years after El Paso about how great the song he wrote called El Paso is. I don't recall who sang the song, but I recall a story that I heard, and as I look down on the city, I remember each and every word. The singer sang about a jealous cowboy and the way he used a gun to kill another cowboy, and he had to leave El Paso on the run. Like, It's a song of. It's not just that it's a song about another song. There's lots of great songs about other songs, but it's a song written by a guy about another song that he wrote when he hadn't really had. He never had another hit that big, you know. He probably never wrote another song that great. But El Paso is a great song, and I mean anybody who doesn't know it needs to go listen to it. You really don't get better in terms of modern cowboy songs than El Paso.
Sure.
One more person, Tom T. Hall, who has an insane number of number one hits as a solo artist. And like, I had no idea until I heard, again, the Cocaine and Rhinestones on Tom T. Hall. Just an enormous number of hits as a solo artist. And he was called the storyteller.
Yeah.
And that's because almost all of his best songs do tell stories. The one all our listeners will know is Harper Valley PTA. By Jeannie C. Riley.
I want to tell you all a story about a Harper Valley widowed wife who had a teenage daughter who attended Harper Valley Junior High. Mama got a note here from the Harper Valley PTA. Well, the note said, Mrs. Johnson, you're wearing your dress is way too high. It's reported you've been drinking and are running around with men and going wild. And we don't believe you ought to be bringing up your little girl this way. It was signed by the secretary, Harper Valley PTA. Well, it happened that...
It's a great song, and it does what he does well, which is there's something very sour at the core of it, and he wraps it in all these details and wraps it in a lot of humor, and it goes down a lot easier. But he's got a bunch of great songs that he sings rather than somebody else sing them. I would point to one called The Ballad of $40. Which is a song about a guy who gets paid $40 to dig a grave for somebody in town who has died. And the whole song is, as he's digging, he's thinking about all the things related to this guy's death and burial and the afterlife and all this other stuff. And, I mean, the implication is he's somehow implicated in this for taking money to bury him. There's another great one called A Week in a County Jail, which basically is nothing but description of what it's like to stay in this crappy county jail. There's no real plot. He gets put in jail for a week for speeding through this, like, hillbilly town. The other one, listeners who are about my age probably know, is I Love, which is a really corny song when he does it, and it gets turned into a truly offensive set of Coors commercials where the lyrics are changed to be about how much you want to have sex with twins. But don't blame Tom T. Hall for that. I'm sure he cashed a check, but he did the real song I Love is bad, but it's not offensive. It's just treacly.
Right. Back on that sappiness.
The year Clayton Delaney died.
Mm-hmm.
Which is about a kind of ne'er-do-well guitar picker in his town. And he hopes he goes to heaven because maybe the good Lord likes a little picking.
A real person who Tom T. Hall knew, like a real known guitar player that I forget if he learned how to play the guitar from him. But that's like one of his actual biographical songs.
I remember the year that Clayton Delaney died. They said for the last 2 weeks that he suffered and cried. It made a big impression on me, although I was a barefoot kid. They said he got religion at the end, and I'm glad that he did. Clayton was the best guitar picker in our town. I thought he was a hero and I used to follow Clayton around. I often wondered why Clayton, who seemed so good to me,
never took his guitar and made it down in Tennessee.
But so this is what Tom T. Hall does well. He tells a story. There's something dark about it, but he's so charming in the way he tells it that you don't notice the darkness at first. He really is a fantastic songwriter, and there's really nobody who writes like him either, which I guess is true of all of these guys, except maybe Mel Tillis.
Watermelon Wine was always my favorite of his too.
Uninvited, he sat down and opened up his mind on old dogs and children and watermelon wine. Ever had a drink of watermelon wine? He asked. He told me all about it, though I didn't answer back. Ain't but three things in this world that's worth a solitary dime, but old dogs and children and watermelon wine.
Old dogs and children and watermelon wine. I like that.
Those are the only things that are worth it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I will admit to liking faster horses. So, is it faster horses, younger women, older whiskey, and more money? That's the real secret of life.
Yes. How about Brett Kavanaugh's favorite song, I Like Beer?
Oh, also a great song. That is a great song.
That's a novelty song, though. That's just a straight-up novelty song.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
One more songwriter who's not on this list, but who I realize, because we were talking about Glenn Campbell earlier, we've got to talk about at some point, is Jimmy Webb. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Webb wrote songs probably mostly known for the Glenn Campbell version. So he did Wichita Lineman. He did By the Time I Get to Phoenix. He did Highwayman, the song done by the Highwayman. He did Waylon Jennings' If You See Me Getting Smaller, which is, I think, maybe the best Waylon Jennings song. And he has these, somebody described Wichita Lineman as the only existentialist country song, and I think there's something to that. Jimmy Webb songs are huge. There's all these, there's all this space in the middle of them, and they fill them up with strings. But they're empty inside, like purposely empty, not in the sense that they don't have anything to say, but they're about human emptiness. And really, there's lots of imitations of Jimmy Webb. And pretty much if you think of somebody else who wrote a song for Glenn Campbell, they're probably trying to write a Jimmy Webb song, like Rhinestone Cowboy. I don't believe is written by Jimmy Webb, but sure sounds a hell of a lot like a Jimmy Webb song. Or the title track to one of Campbell's late albums is Ghost on the Canvas. It was written by the guy from The Replacements, but it sounds for all the world like a Jimmy Webb song. Jimmy Webb, again, nobody writes like him. It's very difficult to describe his music, but you know it immediately when you hear it.
Right. Yeah, I think I had him on the list under the Inspired by Folk Music, and then I took him off because I couldn't find performances by him. It was only stuff that he had written.
He played the piano. He had a couple albums. Oh, you know, we're forgetting maybe his most famous song, MacArthur Park by Richard Harris, or MacArthur's Park, as Richard Harris compulsively sings it. Yeah, and so, I mean, if you've heard MacArthur Park, I understand it's kind of a cheesy lounge song, but that song has most of the hallmarks of a Jimmy Webb joint.
All right, well, anything else about any of the folks we've talked about? We've been going about an hour, and we should try not to have a two-hour episode again.
Willie Nelson, I want to say, like, I think became Willie Nelson after getting out of Nashville. I think he was sort of stuck in that songwriting for other people mode, and kind of if you look at old videos of Willie Nelson singing, he looks so uncomfortable. You know what I mean?
And he wears a suit.
Yes, and it's just not him, right? And so he goes to Austin and sort of takes the show on the road, and that's when, like, you know, Shotgun Willie and Whiskey River and all these sorts of songs that invent Willie Nelson as we know him. I think it's important to note that he couldn't really do that within the confines of Nashville. He had to sort of escape a little bit and become part of that kind of outlaw movement, I suppose, in doing that. So... that's an important thing to note.
Right, which we will get into in the next one, next episode of these.
Can I throw one more writer? I might be a little. He might be younger. He's definitely younger than all these other people, but it's in the early 70s, Rodney Crowell is already. He's in Emmylou Harris's band. He's sort of discovered by Jerry Reed and then makes friends with Kai Clark and all this. And so, but he. He writes a lot of really famous songs before he ever become Ain't Living Long But Like This by Waylon Jennings.
Oh, I didn't know that was him.
That's a Rodney Crowell song. Elvira by the Oak Ridge Boys. These are all Rodney Crowell songs. And Leaving Louisiana by the Broad Daylight. That's one of his. And so he's actually a really one of these Texans who has this. There's a craft that these people their songwriting is like a. This communal art form in that Guy Clark tradition, right? And so, and he's out of that tradition and brings some of that to Nashville too. And he's one of my favorite musicians. So I don't know if we'll ever get to talk about him. Here's the one moment I thought I could squeeze him in.
Yeah, I assume you've heard his record with Vince Gill.
Oh yeah. The it's hard to kiss the lips at night.
Chew your ass out all day long.
The music video for that is fantastic, if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, they're both dressed in drag. You know, I remembered a Mel Tillis song that's worth remarking upon. I don't know why Rodney Crowell brought it up in me, but he wrote one of the worst songs ever written. Kenny Rogers' is Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town.
You think that's a bad song, do you?
Do you not think that's a bad song?
It's a terrible song.
It wasn't me that started that old crazy Asian war. For those of you who don't know the song, please don't listen to it. It is about a man who is paralyzed in either Vietnam or Korea, it doesn't really say, and he can't make money when he comes back, so his wife Ruby tricks herself out all over town.
It is, yeah, one of the most emotionally manipulative things ever written, I think, and just kind of irresponsible. Yeah, it is a terrible song.
The Coward of the County.
Oh.
Well, that one's sappier, but it's less offensive, I think, on some level.
Well, Coward of the County is as sappy as it can be when the centerpiece of the song is a brutal gang rape.
Yeah.
This is true. But at least they're bad. You know, they get their comeuppance, right? And so... Yeah, no, that period is, it's got some low watermarks.
Yeah, I'm honestly not looking forward to the 80s stuff, but, just a word about the politics that, once again, as we've talked about in the past, is mostly missing, right? We've talked about, you know, I think most of the big high water moments from the 1960s and said nothing about Vietnam or civil rights. And it's, I don't think it's because, you know, we don't have any opinions on it, right? Again, country is avoiding these big picture political questions, with maybe.
Except
for
Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town.
Well, yeah. And with the Okie from Muskogee exception, right? Where you get the sort of passing mention of, some of these issues, but, even then, that is sort of an exception, and as we've talked about in the past, the concerns are always, you know, urban versus rural, glorification of the rural lifestyle. Let's get out of these awful cities and get back to the countryside, and just a reluctance to engage with the events of the day, which is especially interesting since George Wallace, tried to identify his campaign for president with country music. And he even got a couple of sort of lesser country singers to endorse him until they realized what he was actually running on. And I don't remember who it was, but I think they both kind of backed down from it, canceled concerts that he was going to appear at and so on. But, even with all of that, you still just don't really see the political stuff showing up. The only country song that even remotely comes to mind, and it's still not directly on the topic, in the mid-60s, Barry Sadler releases The Ballad of the Green Berets.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret.
It was the biggest hit of the year.
Yeah, again, it is political in that it's military, but it's not like we love Vietnam, right? It's Green Berets are awesome and self-sacrificial and all of that. I don't even remember if it mentions Vietnam in it. It's a very non-political piece, despite being a song entirely focused on the military, sung by a Marine, right? I think he was a Marine, Sergeant Barry Sadler. And if not, I'm in a lot of trouble now with a lot of different people.
Well, if he's not, he's in a lot of trouble for going by sergeant.
Well, he might be in, like, the Army or something. I mean, I don't know which branch of service he was in. Military soldier of some kind, Barry Sadler, releases this song, and like you said, it's this huge hit, and still not directly political. And that again is the common theme. The line in Ruby, Don't Take Your Guns to Town, that song's from what, the late 70s, early 80s? I mean, that's still a ways down the road. Anyway, all that to say, still not a lot of politics here. That really does have to wait until the 21st century, when we can start talking about where we're going to put our boot in terrorists' rear ends.
Hey, Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town is 1969.
What? Really? Holy cow.
I didn't know Kenny Rogers was singing then.
Yeah, well, it was Kenny Rogers in the first edition.
Huh.
So he's like halfway between their psychedelic rock phase and their... treacly country music phase.
The famous Big Lebowski with number.
Okay, just dropped in to see what condition my condition is in.
Yeah, that's Kenny Rogers on vocals for that song. Yeah. A lot of people.
Yeah,
it's
Kenny
that.
Rogers in first edition.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. Well, I stand corrected. There is a line in country music about Vietnam or
Thanks,
Korea.
Or Korea. Yeah, it doesn't say.
Yeah.
Both of those are crazy Asian wars.
Right, so they're either, well, I suppose it could be World War II for that matter, I suppose, but they're either very timely or, you know, 20 years too late. So
there's one exception that it's a really funny song. We may have talked about another show, Charlie Daniels' Uneasy Rider. It's a great little narrative of cultural politics in the South. It's a really funny, and from 73, I just looked it up. And so it's of this sort of general time period and a funny kind of parody, at least, of
right, and he has some, right? So the outlaw country will bring some of that back in, if we're calling Charlie Daniels outlaw.
Daniels is Southern rock.
Yeah, that's fair. They played him on the heavy metal station, the classic rock station, around here the other day, and I was like, what on earth is going on here? Like, I'm listening to The Devil Went Down to Georgia right after AC/DC, and that's just messing with me. Well, anything else to add about anything we've talked about today? Otherwise, we'll leave the 60s and move into the 70s next time.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys, for this side trail, I guess, side note to what we usually do on the City of Man podcast. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in the family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or shoot us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, render unto God those things that are God's.
This is a man's cowboy song. The end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along. Another piece of America's lost.